From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Stephen Collinson, White House correspondent for Agence France-Presse. And here are the issues. Russia signed a contract with China to supply the Chinese with natural gas, tightening the ties between the two countries and giving Putin a possible boost in his struggles with the West. Narendra Modi will be sworn in Monday as India's next prime minister as his Hindu nationalist BJP party delivered a stunning defeat to the long-ruling Congress party headed by Rahul Gandhi. As Ukraine prepared for a national election, pro-Russia militants attacked a checkpoint, killing more than a dozen Ukrainian soldiers. And in the United States, President Obama's second term was marred by a new scandal involving medical treatment of military veterans. Well, Stephen, let me start with you. How big a deal is this natural gas contract between Russia and China? It seems like a big deal to me.
Yeah, it's a big deal. There's been a fairly checkered relationship through the years between Russia and China. The most interesting thing to me is it comes at a time when China and Russia are increasingly at odds with the United States. Obviously, the United States is angry at Russia over its annexation of Crimea, destabilization of Ukraine. China is also now angry at the United States. This week, we saw Washington charge a number of PLA hackers in China with what you might call industrial espionage. So. Mm-hmm. At a time when the United States is estranged from both these foes, even more so than usual, you see them coming together to do this natural gas deal. There are a few caveats. Europe will still be the biggest customer of Russia's natural gas. China obviously knows that it can't slake its thirst for energy from Russia alone. So in some ways, you could argue that Putin's search for customers has shown a little bit of Russian weakness. The figures of this deal aren't out fully exposed, but it seems like the Chinese drove a pretty hard bargain, and Putin mm-hmm. probably sold his gas at somewhat of a discount, as he would to European customers who are now looking to sort of diversify their sources of energy after the Ukraine crisis.
David, won't the Europeans now demand a discount, among other things?
Well, pricing is so unbelievably opaque in these deals. I mean, it's not even the price that's opaque. The whole structure of these deals is incredibly opaque. I think what's incredibly interesting about this latest deal is that you had 10 years of negotiations mm-hmm. between Russia and China. I mean, when I was in Beijing a decade ago, they were discussing this.
There
was,
really?
That the Russians were threatening that if the Europeans annoyed them, they would build a pipeline across. You know, people were talking about this 10 years ago when I was there. The fascinating thing about Russia and China is they have never been a kind of happy relationship of equals. There's always a kind of top dog rising and a kind of big brother. So you had throughout the beginning of the kind of the Cold War period, the Soviet Union was unambiguously the big brother. Mm. The Chinese were very much the second partners. You had the Soviets giving Chairman Mao his first nuclear weapon and then becoming alarmed by Chairman Mao, realizing that he was essentially sort of psychotic, taking his nuclear bombs away, shredding the documents. Mm-hmm. He then managed to build his own
without the Soviets. Mao might actually use the nuclear
weapon? He said at a communist summit that it might not be such a bad thing to have a nuclear holocaust, mm-hmm. Which slightly worried even the Soviets. Now you have this extraordinary thing where China is clearly the massively rising power, but it's desperately energy short. Russia has all of this energy. But, you know, if you go near the border areas, they're incredibly paranoid about the fact that you have these large empty expanses of Russian territory next to these extremely crowded areas of Chinese territory. The Russians still have tactical nuclear missiles aimed at China. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had a border war as recently as the 1970s. So these are not countries that naturally sort of sit easily with each other. But clearly, in all manner of fora, like the United Nations Security Council, all of these fora, you have this deal where the two of them are the kind of the veto blocks against what they see as Western bullying and American-led hegemony. And so clearly they have a kind of interests-led relationship together. But do the average Russian or the average Chinese person trust each other an inch? No, not at all. They have historic paranoia about each other.
What will happen if, and I think this may be inevitable, but you all may not agree, that the United States, with these incredible supplies of natural gas, starts exporting that, well, particularly to Europe, which would certainly, Stephen, you mentioned the European market, and particularly the German market being the big market for Russian gas, if the U.S. steps in there.
Right.
And, I mean, it could affect the price, among other things.
That's true. And this deal between Russia and China, I don't think the energy is going to start flowing until 2018. Mm. There's also obviously some time. The US infrastructure is not yet in place to export this gas in massive quantities towards Europe right now. Some people in Washington have kind of questioned the Obama administration's forward planning or even desire to go ahead with this. One thing that also strikes me about this is, you know, the president has made isolating Russia the centerpiece of his response to the Ukraine crisis. This shows that it's kind of difficult to complete that process. If Putin is going to go and sell his gas to China, which, you know, although it has some questions and concerns about what Putin has been doing in Ukraine territorially, is going to look out for its own interests. We already know that the Europeans have difficulties with some of the sanctions, particularly in places like Germany, where there's massive, you know, sort of investment in Russia and many business links to Moscow. So I think it shows it's difficult to isolate Putin. There's one thing that's going to happen in a couple of weeks. Putin's going to show up to the D-Day celebrations in Normandy. He was invited by the French a long time ago, and they said, well, we're not going to rescind this because, you know, we want to recognize Russian sacrifices in the Eastern Front in World War II. So he's going to potentially go to this lunch at a French chateau with President Obama, François Hollande, the President of France, the Queen of England, all these Western leaders that are trying to ostracize him. So, you know, it just kind of underlines that isolating Putin is a good sort of line, but it's actually more difficult to do in practice than might seem obvious.
That sounds like a rather awkward D-Day celebration.
Well, they cope with having Joe Stalin at the Yalta summit. So I think you know, Putin they could.
I know, but that was very controversial and still is in some circles. So
that said, it's important. I think in America and in the UK where I'm from, people forget that the Soviet Union was an ally almost. I mean, it's sort of ignored. But I mean, they did lose many more people than the Western powers did. Mm-hmm. And for them, the Great Patriotic War, as they refer to World War II, was, you know, a defining moment of pride for them. So, right. And I think we're slightly too quick to forget that side.
Well, the Russians tend to forget that they were the allies of the Nazis for 2 years between 1939 and
Molotov-Ribbentrop. Yeah. So you made a good point, though, about American gas. I think people in Washington, I get the impression, are slightly overexcited about the ability of American gas exports to reshape the world. You know, in recent weeks, I have heard the Indians saying that the solution to everything is going to be natural gas coming in tankers from America. The Japanese, American natural gas is going to change everything. You're going to see it changing everything in Europe. You know, there isn't going to be enough gas for everyone to solve their energy problems by buying American gas.
No, I suppose not. So the word is this, I'll start with you, David. What does this do for Putin in his struggles with everybody?
Well, I mean, to some extent, a lot of geopolitics is about hedging. It's not about putting all of your bets in one place. I mean, this deal between China and Russia is hedging for both of them. So the Chinese, not only do they have tremendously, you know, rapidly growing energy needs because they have this gigantically fast-growing consumer economy, they also have a sort of real sense of pinch points. So, for example, it is a source of great angst to the Chinese military and sort of strategic side that so much of their imported oil comes through the Malacca Straits, this very, very narrow maritime pinch point near Singapore. Very easy to close the Malacca Straits in the event of a war. And a huge amount of their oil comes through that. That drives them crazy. So the idea of having an alternative route over the top that's a land pipeline, that's greatly comforting to them. So that's a kind of hedge. Doesn't mean they're putting all of their bets on Russia, but it's a nice hedge. For Putin, you know, as Steve said, you know, they're still going to be sending most of their gas to Europe because it's just much closer, and because, you know, all the pipelines built during the Cold War are still there. Some of these countries like Bulgaria, they get 100% of their gas from Russia. So it's a hedge for them too, because if the Europeans ever were to get their game together and actually create a kind of common European gas market, that would give them much more power to sort of prevent Putin from using his gas as a geopolitical weapon. So everyone is kind of hedging here with this deal. Doesn't mean that it's not a gigantically important thing, but it's not a one-way sort of bet that from now on Russia and China are together against Europe and against the rest of the world.
Stephen, you mentioned that it's very hard to isolate Russia, and Putin in particular. Here he is making the deal with China. He'll be there on June 6th to celebrate D-Day. What does this deal do for him in just his stature and influence?
I guess, in one sense, you know, he's playing the cards he has to play here. But at the same time, the kind of rationale of the U.S. and the European response to Ukraine is to exclude him from clubs. For example, the G8 kicked him out and has now become the G7 and will meet next week in Brussels. So it seems that Putin does value the fact that he is seen as a player on the world stage. A lot of his political project appears to be to restore Russia's political and diplomatic prestige in the world. And if he's standing there with the Chinese president in a big news conference, knocking back a glass, celebrating this deal, that is a potentially powerful image to send back home. So I think he's playing the cards he has. At the same time, it does expose perhaps one of the weaknesses of the Russian economy, that it's so reliant on energy. That kind of points to some questions down the road for the Russians.
David, let's turn to Ukraine, and we'll get to India after that. But Ukraine, there's an election, and the Russians have opposed this election. They don't want it to happen. I guess they've called it illegal, that the ousting the earlier government in Ukraine was illegal. So this election, I guess, would be illegal. That seems to be something that Putin's going to lose on.
They've been kind of selective, aren't they? Because a sort of referendum that some separatists dream up over a weekend and kind of put together into 24 hours, that's just dandy. You know, the Russians are all for those. But then there's got a presidential election actually called by the government of Ukraine.
Right. That's,
you know, that's an outrageous sort of piece of theatre for the Russians. Yeah, no, it's clearly going to take place. All the signs are that it's going to be a runaway victory for this this chocolate billionaire, Petrov. I don't think he's a billionaire. Chocolate tycoon, we'll call him, Petro Poroshenko. He could even win an outright majority. Without a runoff, he may not need to go to a runoff election. But you're seeing the tension. So my own magazine, The Economist, has some reporting this morning from Donetsk, those tense rebel contested cities in the east, the pro-Russian east of Ukraine, where you have the leader of pro-Russian separatists in Donetsk essentially saying that people have no right to vote in this election. You cannot vote for a neighboring state. There's signs of election materials, ballots, seals, that kind of stuff being sort of taken away and impounded to try and physically prevent this election from taking place in the east. So we think the election will take place. We think it could even be actually quite easy win for this chocolate tycoon, Poroshenko. But it will also reveal the degree to which this is not a united country at the moment, the degree to which those Russian-speaking eastern parts are in very, very contested sort of state.
Stephen?
Yeah, and that fact, the fact that it may be, you know, a somewhat messy outcome in the eastern districts, some of which have declared themselves Soviet republics, in a way helps, I think, Putin, because it can only slow or the passage of a united Ukraine towards Europe, the European Union, and sort of Western security structures. You know, it's almost like Putin can't really lose in this, because an election which is not seen as a strong mandate from all parts of the country necessarily weakens Poroshenko. So in a way, I think Putin kind of wins from either scenario that comes out. Another question is, how is Poroshenko, presuming he's the winner, going to govern? You know, there are questions about, is a confectionery oligarch necessarily the kind of person you want running a country? That might raise questions about cronyism. There's some sort of mystery surrounding this guy, what exactly he believes in. He's worked for the previous Ukrainian presidents in various guises. He seems to have channels, at least, to the Kremlin. He has business interests in Russia. There is some sort of school of thought that thinks that the Russians have decided this guy is actually going to be okay for us. We might be able to deal with him on making looser federations, perhaps, for the East. So there are a lot of questions. I think the Europeans and the Americans would like a strong mandate. It doesn't look like they're going to get that countrywide, and I think there's still some murkiness about exactly how Poroshenko would run Ukraine.
You know, when you read about his career, he has worked in the Ukrainian government from time to time, but he doesn't sound like somebody with a lot of governing experience, and they're really taking a big guess on that the voters, I assume, and he seems to be very popular, they're really taking a chance on him.
Well, look, there's nothing magical about an election. And if you kind of go back in history to before this crisis blew up, before you had the ouster of the old president, Ukraine was a mess. I mean, the Ukrainian government was a bunch of sleazy sort of thugs, oligarchs, relatives of oligarchs, and gangsters, basically, looting the place for their own benefit. That was the kind of status quo ante. So the idea that, you know, now we can breathe a sigh of relief because they're having an election, there's going to be a new Ukrainian government. You know, this is not going to be sort of the bright new dawn. I mean, we're going back to the same old sleazy constructions where, you know, this is a country which has never been well governed. It's a young country, at the end of the Soviet Union, this country constructed, you know, always these large language divisions, but basically never well governed, and a series of, you know, even, you know, the opposition leaders who've popped up and described themselves, you know Yulia Tymoshenko, you know, who was put in prison and was there for us a political prisoner and comes out. You know, she was also a crook. I mean, she's incredibly corrupt. There are no kind of good actors in this. So I think we need to be extremely realistic in our sort of expectations of what can come out. But the Russian game, it's not binary. It's not. I don't think the expectation is Russia is about to annex kind of formally giant chunks of the east of Ukraine. It would suit the Russians just fine to have a weak, unstable country where they have lots of influence, where they can pull levers behind the scenes, where they get a veto over any idea of Ukraine forging closer links with the West. Mm-hmm. That would suit them just fine.
That sounds achievable.
Yeah, it's Russia's backyard. I mean, mm-hmm. we have to be realistic about what, you know, what mm-hmm. others can achieve in mm-hmm. this area.
Stephen?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, you know, confusion is good for Putin and good for Russia, and mm-hmm. I don't think this election is going to solve the Ukraine issue as far as the West is concerned. It'll be interesting to see how Western governments judge the conduct of this election. President Obama and German Chancellor Angela Merkel have warned that if Russia is seen to interfere in this election, it could face sectoral sanctions on its economy. Of course, the question is going to be, what is the definition of interference?
Yeah.
It seems mm-hmm. the White House at least views the activities of pro-Russian militias in the East as tantamount to Russian interference. They say that interference equals not intervening to stop this. I think it's, from what I can tell from the Europeans and the Germans, their definition of Russian interference would be much more direct. So at the G7, I think you're probably going to see a debate next week on, or the week after next, on exactly where these sanctions could go. And I think the vision in the US of sectoral sanctions is much less constrained than the vision in Europe of what sectoral sanctions would look like.
All right, we'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder, you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Stephen Collinson of AFP and David Rennie of The Economist. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues in the News as a podcast online. Please visit our website at voanews.com. India, a remarkable election, David. The Congress Party of the Nehru family that has been ruled India pretty much with only several interruptions over the last half century or more, more than that, 70 years or so, losing to this Hindu Nationalist Party, whose leader sounds like Ronald Reagan in one sense, and that is that he's going to master the bureaucracy and have new incentives and a much more vigorous open economy and so on. What do you make of it?
Well, on a good day, he sounds like Ronald Reagan. On a bad day, he sounds like Mussolini. So we have to see which Modi we get. And that is the real conundrum. So if you are an optimist, what has just happened is an extraordinary kind of second chance for India. Remember the history of this. You know, you have India and China, these, you know, more or less equal size neighbors, you know, India's slightly smaller population. And they both took off and India failed. I mean, mm-hmm. India's GDP per capita is way, it's a third of that of China. You know, China, extraordinary growth. India never made it. So you had all these governance problems. You had, you know, this terrible corruption. So there was a kind of real challenge. Why had India not kind of made it in the same way as China economically? This election, you've seen an extraordinary result. Not only has Congress, as you say, the dynastic rulers of India, they've been essentially kind of wiped out, even in their strong sort of strongholds. What you've also seen is they have the Westminster-style parliamentary system. You have, houses of parliament with members mm-hmm. of parliament. The single party, the BJP, has an overall majority, more than half the seats on its own.
Mm-hmm.
That's incredibly rare in Indian mm-hmm. politics. It means they don't need to form a coalition. They possibly will add some other parties to sort of strengthen their majority. But the last time we had an overall majority in the Indian parliament was 30 years ago. That was Congress, and it didn't last very long. So Modi has this incredible mandate for reform. You know, he has this extraordinary mm-hmm. mandate. He doesn't have to do deals with the small regional parties that are often the source of all the kind of corruption and, you know, backroom dealing. He could do, if he sticks to some of what he says, you know, the economic governance part, and mm-hmm. if he listens to the mandate that he got, he didn't just get a nationalist vote. He has a huge nationalist core vote, but he also appealed to the young, people who want to be part of the new rising middle class, and told them that, you know, they'd been stifled for too long. He was going to help them rise. The good Modi has an extraordinary opportunity now. Mm-hmm. The problem is there's also the bad Modi, which I'm mm-hmm. sure Stephen's going to discuss, you know, that this very nasty nationalist, particularly very bad on the issue of Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he hasn't, for the first few days after winning this election, didn't even mention Muslims. That's 15% of the Indian population, mm-hmm. a gigantic number of Muslims.
Right.
And he doesn't even mention them. And he's also, you know, he has a very bad history of, in his past, inciting race riots or condoning race riots or being complicit in race riots that led to the massacre of Muslims. So there's a good Modi and a bad Modi. He has a gigantic mandate, and we now wait to see what he does with it.
Stephen, this has been teed up for you,
right,
to talk about the bad Modi, but you can elaborate however you want.
Right. Well, David's right. The question is, does Modi govern as a Hindu nationalist, or does he seek to sort of appeal to a broader swathe of the population. Signs are that he clearly sees himself as potentially a historic figure in Indian politics of the last 50 years, and to sort of reach that sort of level of reputation, he's going to have to govern with a broader mandate. Another thing that's going to be interesting is his relationships with Pakistan, his foreign relations. He's invited Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif to his inauguration. The big test will come if there is some kind of terrorist attack on Indian soil, and militants accused of carrying it out could be traced to Pakistani camps, as happened with the Mumbai attacks in 2008. Mm-hmm. Another interesting question is his relationships with the United States. President Obama has already invited him to visit the United States, which is kind of a turnaround, because for the last 10 years he's been banned from entering the United States, because when he was state minister of Gujarat, he was accused of not intervening to stop vicious anti-Muslim riots. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of questions about how he's going to govern, his sort of posture towards the outside world. The U.S. government certainly sees potential in reviving its relationship with India, which has gone through a bad patch the last couple of years following President Obama's visit to Delhi. I think it was in 2011. The question is, how much priority does he put on foreign relations, and how much priority does he put to what he said is his... what he was elected to do was to create jobs and sort of alleviate the bureaucracy in the Indian economy. And that, that's a pretty big job. India is notorious for layer upon layer of bureaucracy, which stifles growth. So he has a lot on his plate, put it that way.
David, here we are on The Voice of America. So I will follow up on, what does this mean for the United States? Will this lead to a closer tie with India, which has been rocky at times and better at other times?
I think you have to divide it into the kind of geopolitical side and the economic side. I mean, the geopolitics, the history of relations, during the Cold War, India kind of more or less leaned towards the Soviets. It had that kind of fig leaf of being a non-aligned country, but everyone understood that it was basically, in the camp that was against the West and had a sort of socialistic approach to government. That then ended. You had this kind of rapprochement. You saw under George W. Bush some very strong efforts to try and pull India in, to try and make them a hedge against China. That went pretty well. It involved some big sort of concessions on the American side. America basically looked the other way when India unveiled its nuclear weapons and didn't make a big fuss about it. That was a gigantic concession. And things were kind of reasonably good for a while. Has to be said that if you look at things like, United Nations votes when America needs something on, Iran or Syria or whatever, India is very rarely helpful. It's still instinctively in that kind of non-aligned anti-Western group. But this doesn't, you can't separate that geopolitics from the economics. And there are gigantic possibilities. I mean, one basic thing is some of the most dynamic entrepreneurs in this country, America, are Indian. Mm-hmm. Indian-born Americans. And they go back to India and start businesses in India. There are tremendous exchanges. The number of kind of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, you go to any kind of Ivy League campus, it's full of incredibly smart Indians and American-born Indians and incredible exchanges. So there's amazing potential there. But India is also a rising power, stretching its elbows. You've had some very nasty rows over intellectual property, Indian lawsuits saying that Indian companies have the right to make pharmaceuticals without patents, without paying any license royalties to American companies. Real irritants there in the economic relationship. So it's all to kind of play for. But we shouldn't pretend that these are natural friends. America and India see the world very, very differently, but they have interests which should naturally push them together. And China's one of them. I mean, both of them are scared of China. Yep. So that would be a good reason to get together.
We don't have much time left. And to discuss President Obama's second term, I want to limit it to one question, starting with you, Stephen. And in the United States, there are a lot of people who believe the president's a second term. There's a curse. There's a jinx. It's not like the first term when they can be successful, and the second term is they don't do well. Is there a curse?
It looks, from this administration's point of view, it looks like there is. I mean, it's, strange to think. It's only just over 2 years ago that the president was re-elected. He believed he had a mandate. He had an inaugural address that was replete with sort of liberal ambition. Mm-hmm. He basically hasn't passed a bill since he was sworn in for a second term. The latest issue is this veterans scandal whereby, war veterans have waited a long time. Some of them have died in some cases for treatment, which has just kind of brought up again the question of the Obama administration's management. The president had a big press conference about this scandal this week and didn't seem to do anything but elevate the scandal without telling us what he's going to do to fix it. So I think you can argue that this president is perilously close to being a lame duck, even though you could say the floor on his support is around 40%. He's the people that really like him still really like him, but there's more and more people that are starting to doubt, and the media is already obsessing on the 2016 campaign and Hillary Clinton.
Well, David, there are reasons other than a curse that a second term would be less successful. You have, you know, the best people that were in the administration have left and so on. There are lots of reasons, but what's your take?
I think quickly, there's two things. There's politics. So, you know, the Republicans control the House, and, and the Senate is sufficiently closely divided. The Republicans can block a lot of stuff there. So, you know, there's no doubt the Republicans set out to make a second term as miserable as they possibly could, and they're doing a good job. So the politics is hard. This is a very divided country, and he doesn't really have a sort of overwhelming mandate for a lot of what he wants to do. The other side is just a kind of a technical competence issue. I mean, a very senior figure from his first term was saying the other day, privately, you can't look at him and say he's getting better at this. You know, most people, they do a job for a while. You know, they get a bit better at it. But he isn't getting any better at the kind of business of being president. And Steve's absolutely right. This press conference, you know, this latest scandal, and frankly, you know, the Veterans Administration has been dysfunctional for a very long time.
Forever.
But it was, you know, it was, he sometimes sounds like a kind of academic commentator on his own presidency, you know, rather than someone who is taking responsibility for it. And this sort of slightly sort of peevish sort of chiding the sort of the public for being so irrational. He said at one point, you know, I know the public would like to see, you know, stern punitive actions, you know, it's a swift reckoning, but, you know, we can't, you know, it's as if he's kind of, you know, observing with sadness the sort of the democratic process, which is so sort of messy and ungainly.
President Obama is a little different from other presidents, no question about that. Anyway, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were David Rennie, the Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Stephen Collinson, White House correspondent for Asia en France Press. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.